Previously on The Storyteller, Naked Villainy. From Even Snow to A Locked Up Bull, Kit Harrison's own description of his temper.
But mine has been soured by being locked up like a bull in a small backyard for far too many years.
Brenda's denial she was a prostitute.
In spite of what you constantly accuse, I am no prostitute except with you.
And Kit accuses Brenda of spreading lies about his violence towards her.
Spreading entirely untrue rumours about me and my past to all and sundry.
It's taken 45 years to bring a killer to court. And for the first time in UK history, you'll hear the full murder trial and witness justice being done. It was a brutal murder of a brilliant woman who was a rising star in genetic research.
It would now be almost like a script from Morse. The investigators swarming over the dreaming spires of university land.
There was kind of palpable feeling of evil in the air.
I was told it was just a mass of blood and hair.
2 decades on from confronting evil.
Well, did you kill your ex-wife, Brenda Page?
Evil is being confronted by the law.
Did you kill her?
No.
She knew it was coming.
He said he was going to kill her.
If he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know.
Will his true nature be unmasked?
Are you familiar with the tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
And can Brenda's own words help secure her killer's fate?
A letter of a death foretold.
This is The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. On Tuesday, March the 7th, we arrived at court, eager to hear the final pieces of the puzzle being brought together from the Crown's perspective and the defence, both using the same pieces to paint very different pictures of what happened in the early hours of July the 14th, 1978. But when court was called, we were informed that King's Counsel Brian McConaughey was unwell and not present, so we had to wait until the following morning. It was a painful wait. And remember, this would be the first and only time that the jury would hear the two suggested narratives. As is procedure, the Crown went first. And Advocate Deputy Alec Prentice's opening didn't disappoint.
So, if I depart this earth rather suddenly, please make sure I get a good PM and that my sister or her boys get any benefit. Brenda Page wrote those words in a letter to her solicitor, Nicol Hosey, on the 21st of May, 1977. A letter of a death foretold. He could not bear the thought of any other man being with her, said Sarah McIntyre, sometime professor of the University of Glasgow. He said he was going to kill her, either the day before she was found or the day before that, according to Elsa Christie. On the 14th of July, 1978, Brenda Page was found brutally murdered. Members of the jury, it's my privilege to address you on behalf of the Crown. I've no way of knowing what experience, if any, you have of court. I don't know if you've ever been in a live courtroom or whether your information and knowledge is all gained from films and television books. But you've sat through patiently in a live murder trial. You now know quite a lot about our system and how we operate. You know the different roles we all have. I, as the advocate deputy, am the prosecutor in the case. The term comes from me holding a commission from the Lord Advocate, and I deputise for her. You know about a very important document in this case, and that is the indictment. And you'll recall at the outset the indictment was read to you. The purpose of the indictment is to give notice what this case is all about. It is to give notice to the accused of what allegations are being made against him. It gives notice to the court as to the scope and nature of the case. And it gives notice to you, in broad terms, as to what the case is about. And that's very important, and it's only right and fair that it should be in that manner. Because for evidence to be led in the case, there must be notice given in advance, so that the accused in this case, Christopher Harrison, can answer these matters if he chooses to do so. You will recall on Friday last week that I withdrew all the charges apart from charge number 4. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, it is necessary for corroborated evidence to exist in relation to allegations. And secondly, the precise timings of various things that were said to have occurred is not clear, and there's no criticism of anyone for that because these things happened so long ago. And secondly, I wanted to really focus what this case is truly about. It is about charge 4, the murder charge. But simply because these other charges were withdrawn does not mean you cannot take account of the evidence you heard if you determine it to be relevant to charge 4. And I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that it is. So in other words, you don't wipe away all the things that you heard about allegations in 1973 or 76 or whenever. You can take them into account if you determine they are relevant to the murder charge. And to put another way, if those charges were not on the indictment at the beginning, and I attempted to lead evidence of something which is said to have occurred in 1976, and the only charge was a charge of murder in July 1978, then my learned friend, Mr. McConaughey, would quite rightly have been on his feet to object, to say there's no notice of this. So that's the way it works. So please bear that in mind.
This was important for the jury to hear, because in the moment the charges were withdrawn, you can imagine the jury must have read something into it, and perhaps not in a positive way for the Crown's case. But in layman's terms, the Crown wanted to focus just on the murder charge, and not confuse things, especially if witnesses couldn't give exact dates for alleged assaults and other allegations. He explained that his role was to present the case in a fair and open way, and their role was to apply their knowledge gained through life to decide what evidence they would accept and reject. And it was their recollection of the evidence that was important.
I will not seek to mislead you. No one will in this case. But it's not impossible in a case such as this that's lasted several weeks with a lot of detail that something might be said that you don't agree with. So I make that point.
Mr. Prentice then explained that the two joint minutes were to be accepted as fact. And the reason for the documents was to save a lot of time calling witnesses to confirm things which they could agree on. How the jury would apply those facts to the case would be their decision. He started going through the first joint minute about Brenda's background, when she was born, where she worked and studied, where she lived, the fact it was agreed it was a small property, as shown in the photos, the date of the divorce, 27th of October, 1977.
That date might be quite important for you. And I just want to stress too that what's important in the case is for you to determine. You'll decide what's important, but I suggest that might be important. And then it is agreed that Brenda Page and the accused attended the conference in Vienna, and you heard a bit about that. And then on Friday the 14th of July, 1976, Brenda Page failed to turn up for work. There was no answer to her telephone. At 15:15 hours, Gordon Stevens, Stephen, now deceased, attended, and he rang the doorbell of her flat and got no reply. Access was gained to her flat by Elizabeth Gordon, who was one of her neighbours, using a key, and on entering the flat, Brenda Page was observed lying on her back in the bed, covered in blood and lifeless. She left immediately, advised Gordon Stephen of her findings, and the police were called. Detective Sergeant Eric Jensen, together with scene of crime officers William Bailey and Terence Major, attended and conducted an investigation. And you heard from Eric Jensen, and you'll take account of his evidence too. 15. Brenda Page's body was angled across the width of the bed with her legs over the side of the bed and her feet on the floor. She was wearing a nightdress. The bedding around her nightdress was heavily blood-soaked and she had obvious open wounds to her head. Now that might be a fact you might want to keep in mind when you consider the evidence of Christopher Gannicliffe. I'll come back to that. A post-mortem examination was conducted by Dr. William Henry. She was found to have sustained multiple injuries to the top back of her head and a small fracture at the base of her skull. The injuries in the top of her head appeared to have been caused by an unknown instrument. The cause of death was found to be inhalation of blood. These findings were reviewed during a reinvestigation by Professor James Grieve and Dr. Marjorie Turner, and they agreed with the findings. And you heard from Dr. Marjorie Turner, and I will say something about her evidence in due course. Joint minute number two, you were shown photographs of Brenda Page's motor car, and in particular, the paragraph two, it was agreed that Crown Production 109 comprises black and white photographs of the green Morris Mini Traveller car LVA 426E, which is owned by the accused. And you saw photographs of that in the course of the trial. Now, so there's agreement that's his car. Now, of course, Dr. Harrison accepted that that was his car. But in the detail of the case, you might think there's some importance in that. I'll come back to that. It's agreed that on the 20th of April 1973, Brenda Page attended at Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, where she reported having suffered concussion. So it's just an example of going to hospital, and there's some other evidence about her attending on other occasions, which is not documented in the evidence. Then there are some paragraphs dealing with her work as an escort with Capital Escorts, and agreement that she appears to have met up with some others. Now, that's evidence that could have been led in some other form, but it was agreed just to put that in the joint minute for you to consider, if relevant. And then on paragraph 8, it's agreed that she, again, a further development of that theme, which was set out, that she met people and had engaged in sexual intercourse. Now, there may be some relevance suggested to you in this to do with the sheets. I don't know. But I do want to stress that this is not a court of morals. This is a court of law. And I would urge you to look very carefully at the nature of the work in the escort agency and just to determine whether that had anything to do with this case or not. I suggest it doesn't, but it's a matter for you to consider.
Let's take a breather from the closing speeches, because I want to check in with you all. How are you doing? How's your health? How's your mental health? We all know that looking after our bodies is important, but we often neglect what's going on inside, and that's why I want to tell you about episode sponsor BetterHelp. I've recommended BetterHelp to a lot of friends who've expressed a need for professional support but didn't know how to go about getting it. Busy lives, not enough time, not knowing a therapist were all excuses. Well, I can remove all those hurdles because BetterHelp's 1,000-plus therapists are available at the touch of a button. Whether it's a call from your laptop or smartphone, or even a text, you can engage when and how works best for you. All you need to do is fill out a questionnaire on their website and you'll be matched with a therapist best suited to your needs. Working on your mental health is as important as your daily exercise or gym routine. Healthy mind, healthy life. And it's so easy to sign up. You don't need a referral, and with a special code just for you listeners, you'll receive 10% off the first month. Just go to betterhelp.com/storyteller. That's betterhelp.com/storyteller. Take that first step, you won't regret it. Now let's return to the courtroom. The final section of the second joint minute was acknowledging that the police accurately recorded statements at the time they were given. He explained that he was not going to go through every bit of evidence, as it would take too long. But just because he didn't mention something didn't mean the jury shouldn't consider it. What he was going to mention were issues critical to the questions they would have to answer. Was Brenda Page murdered? And if so, by whom?
Murder is any willful act causing the destruction of life, whether wickedly intended to kill or displaying such wicked recklessness as to imply a disposition depraved enough to be regardless of the consequences. So in other words, you can murder someone really in two ways in Scotland. The hired assassin who takes a revolver to go and shoot the rival gang boss commits murder. No difficulty with that, and I'm sure you understand that. That's a deliberate, intentional, wicked killing without justification. But sometimes murder's committed by an act which is a wicked act, committed in a manner which displays the notion that the perpetrator does not care whether people live or die. I'll give you an example. If a man were to go into a crowded nightclub one evening with a loaded shotgun and to discharge the gun into the crowd, kill three people, it would be no answer to say, I didn't aim it at anyone, I just wanted to frighten people for a laugh. That would be obviously a wickedly reckless thing to do. I suggest to you on behalf of the Crown that this is an intentional killing, that Brenda Page was deliberately killed and in a manner which amounts to murder. But it's not necessary for the Crown to prove that. It would be sufficient if you took the view that whoever did this may not have intended to kill, but the nature of the blows to the head, the number of the blows to the head, the nature of the injuries, all combined together to indicate that whoever did this had no regard to the welfare of Brenda Page. So you don't need to trouble yourself too much with that. But I suggest when you look at the evidence as a whole, you would conclude that this was a deliberate killing. Let's consider then whether this was murder. You recall the computer-generated model which was designed to illustrate the nature of the injuries sustained by Brenda Page. And of course, keep in mind the agreed evidence in the joint minute and the evidence of Dr. Marjorie Turner. Now, Dr. Marjorie Turner told you that Dr. Henry, the pathologist back in 1978, in his report, which we refer to as production 266, said, "This lady died as a result of a violent assault. She had been struck in the face, head, at least 20 times by a blunt instrument, which fractured the base of the skull, caused intracranial bleeding," you'll remember that's bleeding inside the head, "and produced unconsciousness. She died while in a state of coma from the inhalation of blood which originated from her facial injuries." And that has been illustrated in the model. Just take a moment to think of the nature of these injuries. That's not one or two, as you heard. It's in excess of 20. Whoever did that intended to kill, I suggest. But at the very least, whoever did that did not care whether Brenda Page lived or died. Dr. Marjorie Turner told you that the number of blows were more than required to kill. She told you that the extensive bruising on the back of both hands, the overlying abrasion, were all classical of defensive injuries. She told you that phrase is used to indicate injuries which are likely to have been sustained as the individual tries to defend themselves. The natural instinct is to raise hands to protect the head.
He hesitated to rotate the 3D image again, showing the bright red marks where she'd been struck on the head, and then to the extensive defensive injuries. There was absolute silence as the jury took this image in for the final time.
And then we look at the right hand. So keep in mind what Dr. Turner told you. Look at the injuries to the hand. And that's the right hand. Look at the injuries to the left hand and wrist. It's not one or two blows. So when you bear in mind at least 20 blows to the head, apply your common sense and think about the blows to the hands. The hands would protect the head from those blows that struck the hands. Now, in evidence, which I'm looking at just now on the issue of the question of murder, evidence can dovetail into other questions in the case. So, at the moment, I'm seeking to persuade you that murder was committed here. But you've seen the evidence of the hands being used to protect the head. Does that chime with any other evidence in the case? You will recall the police officer, Ian Duncan, read a statement to you which was taken from Thomas Gray, a porter at the hospital where Brenda worked. And when she talked about her trouble in her life, you'll recall there was a quote from Brenda Page. "I always protect my head." Does that have relevance in assisting the determination of the second question? Who was responsible? So I invite you to conclude that Brenda Page was murdered. I suspect there's no controversy over this, but it's for the Crown to prove. But I suggest to you that the answer to the first question, was the crime of murder committed, should be a resounding yes, and really could be no other answer. But let's consider the nature of this killing. At least 20 blows to the head. The hands were struck. Apply your everyday life experience and common sense to this. Why so many blows? Does that suggest a targeted rage?
You'll have noticed Mr. Prentice spent quite a lot of time labouring a point that might be obvious. You'd think the jury wouldn't have to question whether this was a murder, but by law, it's important to establish that. It also gave the AD the opportunity to revisit the evidence that was heard weeks prior and put fresh in their minds the awful truth of the extreme level of violence used to kill her. There were at least 20 swings, weapon in hand, that made contact with Brenda's face and head, and many more that struck her hands and arms.
The real issue in this case, members of the jury, is who was responsible for the killing. So I invite you to conclude at this stage you should say, yes, murder was committed. I'm satisfied with that. Let's get now down to what the true issue in the trial is. Who was responsible?
He took some time to go through the types of evidence before piecing together the puzzle. Firstly, direct evidence, which is, for example, an eyewitness who saw a crime being committed. There was no direct evidence of the murder in this case, he explained, but that was not unusual. Most serious crimes are not carried out in the public gaze. Nor was there direct evidence of CCTV, etc., as they didn't exist in 1978. Indirect evidence, or circumstantial evidence, he said, could be referred to in everyday conversation as an, oh, it's just circumstantial evidence, as though it's weak. But he explained in court, circumstantial evidence is none the weaker and often carries more weight. Direct evidence can be undermined. High emotion, a fleeting glimpse of a killer fleeing, mistakes could be made. He said it might not be as reliable, whereas a combination of circumstances and facts established may allow them to reach a proper conclusion.
The key theme of my address to you, members of the jury, is don't look at evidence in isolation. Look at the evidence as a whole. It is in the nature of circumstantial evidence that it may not be incriminatory when looked at in isolation, but it may form part of a body of circumstantial evidence which, when considered in combination with other evidence, presents a compelling picture. Sometimes it is likened to the strands of a cable. You might have a strand which is particularly weak on its own, but when combined with other strands, gradually they build up to form a cable which has great strength. Let's consider how this might apply in this case. A paint flake is found near a window. It is examined and found to be indistinguishable from another taken from a car. So, if we stop there, that really doesn't tell you a great deal. But there's a connection between two paint flakes, possibly. Let's add a circumstance, or a strand. The first was found at the point of entry at a break-in. Well, that advances the picture a little, you might think. Let's add a circumstance. The break-in was Brenda Page's flat. Let's add something else. The second flake came from Kit Harrison's car. So what does that tell you? Well, as has been said, circumstantial evidence may be capable of many interpretations. So if we just stop there, what do we conclude from that? Well, it could be, if we add a circumstance, that Brenda Page had been in Kit Harrison's car, so that paint flake might have been deposited when she opened the window for ventilation or to let the cat in. So that's one explanation. Of course, another explanation could be it was deposited, as Eric Jensen said, it was one explanation when someone climbed in that window at the point of entry at the break-in. So these are two on their own of equal weight, you might think, and you have to determine where the balance lies beyond a reasonable doubt. So let's add something else. Brenda Page was murdered, if you so determine. Let's add something else. The relationship between Kit Harrison and Brenda Page was, to use a word, problematic. Let's add something else. A day or two before her death, Kit Harrison said he would kill Brenda Page, if you accept that evidence. Let's add something else. Brenda Page had been in fear of Kit Harrison. He did not like her work, which she referred to as her whoring. So you can see how the combination of circumstances might inform you as to what interpretation you should place upon individual circumstances. Let's add something else. Brenda Page met clients at the Treetops Hotel on the evening of the 13th of July 1978. A car, like Kit Harrison's, was seen at the Treetops Hotel by Heather Lindsay, possibly around 9:40 p.m. So you can begin to see all these different layers being added to form a picture, if you choose to look at it that way. It's entirely a matter for you, of course. But I urge you to look at the evidence as a whole and not to look at the evidence in isolation. Look at it as to how it might fit in with the whole of the evidence.
He went on to say it was important for them in the beginning to approach the trial with an open mind and view the evidence dispassionately. But now they've heard all the evidence, now they can make their judgments. He said it might feel strange for them to be deciding upon events which occurred before many of them were born. A case of this age brought challenges, relying on memories.
But we have the advantage of some documents, some photographs, some memories of things. But a case of this age brings with it real challenges. There's no question about that. You have to rely on people remembering things. It's a long time ago, and witnesses will not always remember things accurately. That's human experience, we know that. On the other hand, when something so dramatic, so awful as the violent death of a loved family member or valued and respected colleague happens, you might think some detail at least would stick with you forever. That's the sort of thing you need to address when you consider the evidence in the case. You heard from Rita Ling, Brenda Page's older sister, and she was able to tell you that Brenda Page said the relationship with Kit Harrison was like walking on eggshells, and that Kit Harrison was unpredictable. She said he hurt her, and she gave examples such as a book being thrown at her. Sometimes in a trial, a question may be asked that might be slightly puzzling in the early stages. We don't have opening speeches, so you were simply advised of the allegations against Kit Harrison, and you were read a joint minute, which hopefully would fill in some background, at least at the beginning. But you might wonder why Rita Ling was asked about whether Brenda Page was someone who was neat and tidy and paid attention to cleanliness, and she said she was. I suggest Brenda Page is not someone who would not regularly launder her sheets. Brenda Page told Rita Ling that she was convinced that Kit Harrison was following her and had been in her flat in Allen Street. Now, you have to be very careful with this evidence, because the allegations made by Brenda Page are communicated to you through witnesses who heard them being said to the witness, to letters which have been produced. But of course, Brenda Page couldn't give evidence in this case. Our law permits evidence to be led of what a deceased person said, when it's in the form of a statement or in some other form. And you're entitled to take that into account. But you don't have the advantage of seeing the witness give evidence. The witness is plainly not placed on oath or taken up an affirmation, and is not subject to cross-examine, challenge. So you have to take all that into account. And it's partly for that reason that I asked quite a number of colleagues and friends about the comments that were made. But please remember that the source, being Brenda Page, is a single source. The fact that she said it on many occasions is not corroboration. But it might cause you to think, well, if this is all concocted, which is what the suggestion is in this case, why would you tell so many different people? Rita Ling told you the last she saw of Brenda Page was the weekend before she died. And she was in a generally good mood, but did not want to go back to Aberdeen because she was afraid that Kit Harrison would still be pestering her. Not true, the accused says. Not true. I was always kind and generous, the accused says. Diane Davey spoke of the fact that Brenda Page was terrified of Kit Harrison. Brenda Page was security conscious. She was aware she'd taken out a court order against him. And Diane Davey said she witnessed aspects of Kit Harrison's behaviour, his temper. Nicol Hosey, the solicitor, now an employment judge, was instructed to proceed with the divorce. Now again, bearing in mind it is your task to decide what's important in the case, I invite you to consider that Nicol Hosey's evidence is important and significant. When he was first consulted by Brenda Page He told you that Brenda Page made the claim that she'd been thrown out of the matrimonial home, and she provided details of the behaviour, which included violence, all of which was to justify the divorce. And she produced a witness, Elizabeth Lane, a pair of marked trousers, and a doctor's report on aspects of the claim. And Nicol Jose, who dealt with matrimonial cases in that time, clearly formed an impression that Brenda Page was scared of Kit Harrison. And then you'll recall that he received a letter of the 21st of May 1977, which included what I suggest were the chillingly prophetic words, "So if I do depart this earth rather suddenly, please make sure I get a good PM and that my sister or her boys get any benefit." What an extraordinary thing to write. But it's not the first time she had expressed a concern of that nature. But she wrote that to her solicitor. And she also produced an account of what she said had occurred. And you'll recall that Nicol Jose said that Brenda Page, obviously being a clever and articulate person, was able to detail the information which would form the basis of the court case. And the case proceeded. There was the divorce on the 27th of October 1977. Of course, point was properly made to Nicol Jose that as a solicitor, he's just in gathers information. He personally can't judge whether what's being told to him is true or not. And he just prepares the court documents and presents them to the court. There's a basis on the surface, at least, but whether these allegations are true or not, it's really not for him to say. But I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, to conclude that they were true. That this was the combination of events which ultimately led Brenda Page, who on all accounts deeply loved Kit Harrison, and he deeply loved her. But the point had been reached. This was too much. She could go on no longer with this, and divorce was the way forward. And details were put in the summons, which would ultimately be the basis upon which divorce would be sought. Now, the accused in this case said, "Well, I never read it. She could see anything she liked. It was the end, so I didn't really bother." And of course, that may be the case. You can look at that. But there were no children of this union. The financial situation seems a little complex at first, but it was sorted out. So that should have been that, so far as the two of them were concerned. And it was, if you believe Kit Harrison. He did not pester her. He did not attend on her unless she freely consented. Really? The reality, I suggest, and it's for you to determine, is that matters could not be left by him. Because he could not bear the thought of Brenda Page being with another man. And you'll recall that an interim or temporary interdict, a court order, was sought, and it became a permanent interdict. And it was required. For what purpose? The order was to prevent and prohibit Kit Harrison from molesting, annoying, or calling at her flat or place of employment, threatening to injure, phoning, following. Why would that be required? Dr. Harrison appeared to suggest that the allegations of violent and abusive conduct was all concocted with a view to just getting the divorce that she really wanted because they couldn't have children, and that's the real reason behind all this. Well, if that's true, what on earth was the purpose and reason for seeking an interdict after the divorce to prevent Kit Harrison from pestering her, unless he was. Now, of course, you know from your everyday experience and life experience, human relationships are really complex. There is no doubt, I suggest, on the evidence that Brenda Page and Kit Harrison loved each other and continued to love each other. Anne Lemon told you that Brenda Page said that she loved him very much and wanted the marriage to work, despite the unpredictability of his behaviour. You've heard from a number of witnesses about Brenda Page's view of the relationship, his behaviour in hitting her, organising life to suit himself. I suggest that Brenda Page had become desperately unhappy, but she had good supportive companions in her family and work colleagues, and that she would be torn between those real emotions of love towards someone that she agreed to marry and wanted the marriage to last, and that she had a genuine fear of being killed, something she said on a number of occasions, including a comment to the effect that if he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know. Why tell so many people? If it's concocted for the purpose of the divorce, just tell a willing, colluding friend to go and get the divorce and that's it all done. What would be the purpose of sharing it with people such as Sarah McIntyre and other work colleagues, Jesse Watt, all highly clever, you might determine, respectable people? And I suggest the witnesses in this case have all been doing their absolute best to tell the truth. With one exception, Dr. Harrison. I invite you to reject his evidence.
I'm going to stop there. His speech was not yet over, but I know there's a lot to absorb. This is not a TV drama, where a dramatic monologue lasts a couple of minutes. As I keep reminding you, this is real and boxes needed to be ticked for points in law. And that's why both sides would meticulously go over key points of the evidence. Key points jury members may have missed or not realised the relevance of. This was their one and only moment to persuade the jury to view the evidence through their lens. In the next episode of The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, the most damning testimony from Kit's own friend.
Very angry, and said he was going to kill her.
The Crown's reason for believing Kit lied to the court about not following Brenda.
The obsession, I suggest, with her, as he described it, whoring. And I also suggest the idea that he would have no idea that she would go to the Treetops Hotel is implausible.
And why Kit's sperm was found on the blood-soaked sheets.
I invite you to conclude there was ejaculation at the time of the murder.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review, as it makes a huge difference to guiding people to hearing this important story. This is an entirely independent production and your support is greatly appreciated. And if you want to hear exclusive interviews, longer episodes and insights, please head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Thank you again for listening. This is a piece of history, and you are, for the first time in this format, witnessing justice being done.